Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We are going to be looking at the governor's budget today, and would like to welcome everyone to the committee. Would ask members to find their places. We do not yet have a quorum. When we do, we will call the meeting to order. But we have quite a bit of material to cover, so I want to begin on time, as we always do. And we have with us Commissioner Jessen to begin the overview. So I would kick it off to you, Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I'm going to just make a few overview comments, present some of the challenges and the way we thought about putting together the governor's budget for the Department of Human Services. And then I'm going to be joined for the different sections by the assistant commissioner that's responsible for first children and family, then mental health, and then direct care and treatment. And we also, if there are in-depth questions people have, we certainly have other experts in the room who can provide those. You know, I think sometimes when you think about budgets, we're tempted and we almost automatically go to what are the major problems and how do we solve them. But I do want to really start by reflecting on how lucky, at least certainly I feel, to be Commissioner of Human Services in the state of Minnesota. You know, and just if we think about where we are in our state, while there are challenges, and we'll talk about those, we start from a very good place. You know, just last summer, the Commonwealth Fund said that Minnesota had the best health care system in the country. And that's not obviously just state government, but that says so much about our health care system, which is a large part of what we do. That we have the number one long-term care system, the number one home and community-based service system in the country when you look at both access and quality and cost. We're number four when it comes to the way we provide for low-income citizens in our state, which I think is a good thing as well. And we're the number one state, healthiest state for seniors. There are a lot of other kind of rankings, but I think that really just says, I wanted to start there because while we talk about challenges, I do think it's good to step back and think about what a good job our state has done on so many levels, not just obviously because state government, but all but the citizens of our state and the value they place on serving, protecting, and providing ladders out of poverty for our most vulnerable citizens. So when we thought about this budget, we really wanted to step back and think, where is the system most fragile and where are people at risk? And when we did that, and I'll just walk through a few slides, we did obviously start with, you know, where are appropriations now? Where are we spending money now at the department? And this is a slide, Mr. Chair, members, I know many of you all are responsible, are very familiar with, but I put it up here because it makes the point that we spend 77% of our human services dollars on health care when you look at basic health care and long-term health care. And then if you add kind of our state-operated direct side, you get to about 80% of those dollars. And when we were thinking about it.
Sure.
Yes.
If I could interrupt you just for a quick minute here. We do have a quorum, so we're going to go ahead and begin the meeting. And Commissioner Jessen, we'll call the meeting to order. And if I could have approval of the minutes for January 27th, 2015.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval.
Representative Peterson moves the minutes from January 27th, 2015. We have a second. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Commissioner Jessen, first of all, I think you're referring to the handouts, not the very large budget book. Is that correct? I believe it is.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I will reference the pages in the budget book when we come to the different proposals so members can track easily.
Thanks, Commissioner Jessen, and thanks to the committee for committee staff for sticking around and putting together these gigantic budget books, staying up and late to do that. We appreciate that. And I think they're about $1.5 million an ounce in terms of budget, but we appreciate all the hard work that people put that together. We also do have a committee page, which is Nick Nigro. Wave hello. Welcome to the committee. He'll be with us for the rest of the session. So with that, members, if you want to look at the colored packets that were handed out by Commissioner Jessen. We'll follow along and reference the large budget books as the presentation unfolds. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption, Commissioner Jessen, and please continue with your testimony.
As I said, when we looked, stepped back and looked at where we spend our money, we also looked, and I borrowed this slide from the Department of Health, you know, at where that money goes. And so a lot of that money goes to kind of our clinical care, our traditional health care system. And I put this slide up there to remind all of us, and we were looking at this at the department, that there's so much that goes into trying to have stable, healthy children and families beyond just our traditional health care system. And we have invested a lot over the last several years in our traditional health care system to and covered more Minnesotans than cutting our uninsured rate almost in half. We've also made a lot of investments in long-term care, home and nursing facilities, home and community-based providers. And overall, when we looked at this, at the where we saw the greatest needs overall, it was the number of children that today are living in poverty in our state, and the number of them specifically that are living in deep poverty. And so we were trying to figure out what we could do to address, to turn that around, especially when it comes to intergenerational poverty that I know many of you are familiar with, that we have, you know, teenage moms on our welfare to work, our InFit program, and 75% of them, their moms were on that program. How do we really get at this challenge and help bring those children, give them those ladders out of poverty? And the second major area that the governor's budget looks at is our mental health system. You know, we have so many great providers and parts of our mental health system, but, and we'll go into this in more detail, today I think our mental health system is very fragile. There are a lot of gaps in different parts, and those gaps are different in different parts of the state. And we spent a lot of time, I did myself too, going around the state and meeting with providers and counties and, you know, and advocates and just people who use, clients who use our systems. And these aren't just for people on public programs, but really overall kind of our families who need the services our mental health system provides. And it is fragile, and we've seen that through the closings of places like Riverwood and the fact that we have too many people that wait in line for care, or in greater Minnesota have to drive an hour and a half to see a provider. So those are kind of, from our perspective, the two major things you'll hear about in our budget proposals. And when you think about particularly our mental health system, it also gets to the role of, and what role should the state play through our direct care and treatment in our mental health system? And that is something that we also are taking a look at, and you'll hear more about today. Office of Legislative Auditor, and very much we thought we need to re-examine the role the state plays as a safety net provider. And with a lot of changes in our healthcare system, say, look, where are there people that aren't being served on the in the private side that are lacking for services? Because maybe we need to expand there. But are there services that, at least under certain conditions, the private sector would step up and provide? Or they are, because we're not trying to compete with the private sector. We're trying to really look at what are the needs of the safety net. So you'll hear some of our proposals about proposing to really change the footprint of our direct care and treatment and do more in for some of the mental health services that we think others aren't providing, people with mental illness who are public safety risks, for example. But there are also parts of our budget and our direct care and treatment as we're looking at the broader mental health and kind of corresponding CD system where we think that with the appropriate rates, the private sector could and step up, and we should encourage them to do that. So I'm just going to go through a few slides kind of at a high level, and I think we saw some of these before, a few of them, that illustrate the challenges in these areas. You know, and one just starts with the fact that, you know, the mental health capacity in our system is fragile and missing in parts of our state, and that impacts, I think, almost every family in Minnesota, where one in four of us at some point in our lifetime will have some kind of a mental illness. And we also see real gaps in our substance use treatment, where only one in 18 Minnesotans that have some sort of substance disorder are receiving treatment. access, we will see a proposal and hear about it for dental care in our state. You know, overall, our public programs do a good job at providing quality care for our enrollees, but we really have a gap in access in dental. And that is particularly acute for children. So what the percentage, what this slide basically says is only 30% of the children on our public program are receiving the preventive dental services that they should get. That is significantly below the national average, and we're a state that's used to being near the top of the national average. And as I said earlier, increased child poverty is a real challenge. You see that kind of over the last 10 or more years overall, I mean, there are variations, but the number of children living in poverty is going up, and that's particularly true for our youngest children. And it's not a surprise then, with those more children living in poverty, that we've seen the number of homeless children in their families almost quadruple in per one-night shelter count. So of the, if you look at the Wilder studies that are done, go out and count how many people in Minnesota are homeless on a given night, that 46% of those people are children and youth under 21. I think that would surprise most Minnesotans and is very troubling. And as we've talked about before, recently, we have challenges with the age wave, where we have really a doubling of our population over 65 coming soon upon us, and we need to prepare and have, I think, some other strategies other than just our Medicaid system to deal with those challenges. So these are kind of the budget priorities in the governor's budget to try and address these challenges. And unless there are particular questions about the overview, Mr. Chair, I would ask Assistant Commissioner Jim Koppel to join me and go through the children and family proposals.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. And Commissioner Koppel is coming forward. Are you going to be available? Are you going to for the remainder of the time today? If people have questions, or are you going to be coming back, or what is your time frame?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I plan on being here during the entire presentation and the question period, and I was going to have the different assistant commissioners come up and join me for their parts, where they'll take most of that, but I'll probably weigh in on some things as well. So I will be here for this entire period, as I will for the hearing tomorrow as well.
Great. I appreciate that, and if members could maybe write down questions and hold them off as much as possible, because we do have quite a bit of material and presenters, but I think if they will be around for a question period, it would be helpful, unless it's unless something is very off, to hold off questions until they can present through their material, so that we have enough time for questions. Thank you. Mr. Koppel, please introduce yourself for the record and start ahead with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Koppel, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I did want to start and just highlight some of the investments the legislature and governor have made in the last few years, which I think are really going to improve things for children in our state. So just this month, we're launching North Star Care for Children, which is increased funding for relatives and others that want to adopt children out of our children over the age of six out of our foster care system. We have state wards whose parental rights have been terminated. These kids are waiting for families, and I think the additional investment that this program is making is meaning more children have permanent homes. So we're delighted about that. And we expanded support for families in the past several years as well through our parent support outreach program, which we took statewide, so that the families that we identify as needing support, but they're not yet in our child welfare system, but if we get them some additional supports, hopefully we can keep those families intact and together and keep those children safe. And our improved child care quality through Parent Aware. So we now have 29% of the children who are in our CCAP program, so our child care assistance program the department runs, 29% of them are in programs that are quality rated, 3 or 4 star rated programs. So more of those kids are going to be ready for kindergarten. And the increased funding for sex trafficked youth and homeless youth that is really making a difference in the lives of those kids. And the housing assistance grant for some of the infant families. So I just wanted to start out by highlighting, I think, some progress that we have made before I turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Koppel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Just one introductory slide before I go into the budget pages would be this, the challenge of that we have before us that was alluded to by the commissioner, and that's poverty and children in poverty. And while Minnesota ranks very high in many quality of life indicators, we rank at or near the bottom in our disparities. And when you look at the fact that 1 in 10 white children live in poverty, as opposed to half of all African American children and 40% of Native American children, we have work to be done. And I want to emphasize that it isn't just poverty as a statistic, it's life and the quality of life and the opportunities in life for those children. And if you look at many of the issues we talk about, child protection, you have a tremendous overrepresentation in the child protection system of kids in poverty. You have a huge overrepresentation of high school dropouts in the juvenile justice system and the adult prison system of people who, as children, grew up in poverty. And it's this persistent long-term poverty and deep poverty that we need to address to assure future success, break these intergenerational problems that continue to haunt us and really detract from so many great programs that we try to run if we don't get at this core issue. So with that, I'd like to start with the budget book, and I'll refer to the pages to hopefully that will be helpful. The first page is 12, and it is the simplified child care assistance requirements. The first three items I'll talk about all have to do with the child care programs. This first one, I'll wait a minute for people to get to the page. This first one is a governor's initiative which recommends for that the child care assistance program needs to have some flexibility for easier access for families, supports the developmental needs of children as a priority, and reduces the complexity of the program. So what this one recommendation does, and it would majority of the money, about $1 million when fully implemented of this per year, would go to about 400 families that would allow children in those families to have access to the child care that is appropriate for the child and is less prescribed, which is a departure from current practice, which right now we find out how many hours you work, where you what the hours of the day are. It's kind of micromanaged. This gives the families the flexibility if you're going to school, if your schedule changes, or if your child has opportunities for more child care in a highly rated program, then that is made possible through this flexibility. So we'll be starting it up in 16 and 17 and be fully implemented in the next biennium. And it all, the other piece of this is that we also changed the way that we look at overpayments. It's not a large amount of money. These overpayments are not due to anything. If it's fraudulent, obviously, we go after it. In many cases, these are average payments that comes out to very small amounts over the course of a year for providers, but sometimes cause family and providers hardships on the recollection of these monies, and it's costly administratively. So we are going to back away from a few of those collection thresholds and look back periods, as well as some errors that are our own or a county's errors, and we won't be recollecting that money. That is item number one. The next item is on page 15. This is an expansion of the basic sliding fee program, $12.5 million in this biennium and $20 million in the next biennium to address the waiting lists for child care. when we talk about employment as well as preparing our children for school. Child care plays a tremendous role. And while we assure child care for MFIP families and those transitioning off of MFIP, we do not insure it for working families through the basic sliding fee program. And in fact, there's over 6,000 families on a waiting list now. So this expansion would provide child care for over 10% of that waiting list, and it would be targeted toward those counties, and nearly 20 counties with waiting lists. It would be targeted toward those counties with the waiting lists. So there will be rider language that would show that distribution. The majority of the funds would benefit families with children under five. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to keep rolling. Page 17. Sustaining Parent Aware Quality Rating and Improvement System. As the Commissioner mentioned, we have about 29% of children basic sliding fee or in child care receiving their care at highly rated programs. This would expand that over the next 4 years to 40% children ages 0 to 5 and receiving child care assistance to be enrolled in highly rated parent aware programs. That would be 3 and 4 star rated programs. This is, as many of you know, for the last 5 years, we've been under the Race to the Top funding from the federal government. That funding is ending, and this would be the state picking up some of the costs of this parent aware program. Then we move to those are the three proposals around child care. We're now moving toward some tribal funding issues and initiatives. The first one is on page 21. It's the White Earth Nation transfer funding. Legislation passed in 2011 created the authority of the White Earth Nation to assume responsibility for providing human services for its members. As we discussed then, this is a very important transition because we feel that the tribal members will get more services, will have more appropriate services, there'll be a better access points for those members. The White Earth Nation, since this was created and started in 2011, is now serving, as of this September 2014, about 10,000 individuals. This is recipients of health care, MFIP, SNAP, and child care from the neighboring counties. And they have added 16 workers, financial workers, at their costs to accommodate this workflow. The $1.4 million that's in this budget would give the White Earth Nation the money, the budget, to accommodate that additional workers.
Mr. Chair, if I could add something here.
Commissioner Justin.
I think this is really part of a department initiative that started certainly long before I came to the department to try and work with tribes who are willing and able, who wanted to basically deliver their own human services services. Where we did this, and White Earth was one of them, for child welfare services, what we saw was when you had the tribes doing it, that the kids had better outcomes. There were fewer out-of-home placements. And there were, you know, I think the tribes would say because they were partly it's the family connections, the more culturally appropriate services. So we really, American Indians has some of the largest health and child welfare disparities. And so that's what we're trying to do with these proposals, is to try and make it possible for the tribes to pick up more of those so we hopefully have better outcomes for these children.
Mr. Cotton.
Okay, the next budget item is on page 23. It's a Red Lake Tribal TANF program. Red Lake was approved last year from the Department of Health and Human Services to operate a tribal TANF program. This is our TANF for new members. That's our, in Minnesota, we call it the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It's a temporary need Temporary Assistance to Needy Families is what that acronym stands for. So I'm trying to stay away from acronyms if I can here. So Red Lake will receive a portion of our block grant to design and operate their program. In addition, they would like to eventually be providing more human services to the way the White Earth Nation has done, as I was previously explaining in the previous budget page. So this would be a beginning of that process. There is $34,000 in this biennium for work that the department would do on the Maxis computer system. And there would be one FTE that the department would add in the 18-19 fiscal year to work with Red Lake on that, taking over that program. Next, on page 24, the American Indian Family Early Intervention Program. I know we have presented and talked about our child protection system and the needs we have in that that system. This budget item has to do with providing early intervention grants that can be used to serve approximately 1,800 families during the first 2 years to look to keep Native American children out of the child welfare system or to intervene earlier enough that we don't get into the foster care, out-of-home placement services that currently are necessary. And in fact, they're six times more likely to be abused or neglected than white children and are 15 times more likely to be placed in foster care than white children. And we need to address this issue, and this money grant program would establish some early intervention programs directed toward those children and their families. I would also add there will be an evaluation of the program, and which will be contracted by the department. And so $100,000 of this money would be toward that annual evaluation. Lastly, we have the Tribal Customary Adoptions Grants. This is no change in base funding or the budget as a whole. What this does is just clarify that the allocation of money that currently goes to Leech Lake and White Earth would be based on some historical funding, but we would handle contracts that have to do with contracts within the reservation, where currently the money goes for their actually contracted with themselves. We would be doing those contracts where there could be any potential conflict of interest. Next, on page 28, is the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women. Very important initiative here that Governor is recommending to improve birth outcomes and strengthen early parental resilience for women at high risk for adverse outcomes of pregnancies. We have a significant increase in the number of babies born with addiction. Drug-related issues, and so what we want to do is have early identification and treatment of during pregnancy, and from other experiences, we know that there is great return on this investment, and that is shown in the first 2 years. We're going to spend almost $300,000 in the coming biennium in 18 and 19. There will be savings of $1.3 million, a little over that. So there is a great return on this investment. It will cut down on the number of preterm births as well as long stays in the neonatal intensive care units at hospitals. The next item is the healthcare, another healthcare. Some of these are healthcare items, but I'm talking about them because they're child-focused. The next one is oral health initiative. This one does also have money, and for periodontics for adults, but I want to talk mainly about the children's portion. It's a $10 million in this upcoming biennium and $16.7 million in the 18-19 biennium. What this would do would address what the commissioner talked about earlier, that children in Minnesota have below national average, and the national average is actually troubling in itself. Across the country, states struggle with this issue of access to oral health for children. And this is what we're trying to address in this proposal. It would increase the base rate for dental services by 15%. It would update rate methodology to reflect the percentile charges in 2012, so a more recent year. It eliminates some of the add-ons that we had put on as interim steps previously because of this change in the core in the base rate, which would accommodate that. And as I mentioned, it would also add coverage, some coverage for adults for periodontics. These changes help to better align payments reflecting more recent charge-based data. They decrease reliance on add-on payments and they overall improve payment rates for private dental clinics. The next item is the child protection oversight. This is on page 33. Governor recommends additional funding for oversight of the state's child protection system. Again, in the short presentation we gave, and I know that it was a policy committee that's heard Representative Crecia's bill, but this initiative is to provide the state with additional FTEs, which would be directed toward overseeing our county-administered child welfare system. What we're trying to do is to develop best practice protocols. We're trying to have best practice training. And I'll just give you a general statement here, and that is we have 87 counties, and we have, at times, 87 different child welfare programs. And what we're trying to do is better align those so that a child is going to get the same opportunities or interventions or that family needed services in every county. And there won't be the kind of disparities that exist depending on what practices are in that county. So we'll be developing protocols and bulletins, and we'll be developing databases that will better inform care and help to make better decisions and have that be more uniform across the state.
Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add a couple of things. This will also provide for some additional training. So this proposal addresses the initial recommendations of the Governor's Child Protection Task Force, which called for more oversight and training by the Department. The Governor and I are both very cognizant of the fact that the final report from the task force is not due till the end of March, and the Governor's committed to looking at those additional recommendations and seeing if there are other capacity and resource issues that need to be addressed. But we thought it appropriate to at least, in the Governor's budget, address the initial recommendations.
Mr. Chair and members, the next item is on page 36. Eliminate the application fee for child support services. Minnesota's child support system currently provides 398,000 families with help in establishing paternity, getting and modifying child support orders, and collecting child support. Minnesota currently charges these families a $25 application fee to receive child support services. Now, the governor recommends here is that we do away with the fee. The technicality is that the federal share of the fee, the state must continue to pay 66% to the federal government. But the fee will be reduced to 1 cent, and we will pay 65% of that, or 66% of that, to the federal government, which is why that zeroes out in the coming years. We think that this is doing away with what could be barriers to low-income families entering a child support system and having to pay to get in. So we are doing away with the fee, that $25 fee, and there won't be any implications as a result. The next item is the North Star Foster Care Residence Setting and Funding Clarification. The commissioner mentioned that we're implementing that program now. It was passed last year, and there was some confusion. I think the intention was, if you look on page 39, the intention was that on the last two lines on page 39, that this would be a forecasted program and not a grant program. It doesn't change any of the numbers. It just moves it to a forecast so that there are a number of grant programs that operate within North Star. This allows those grant programs flexibility to move the money as opposed to being stuck. I believe most people thought that we had forecasted it. This just clarifies that we did. The next item on page 40 is the Minnesota Food Assistance Program. This was an item that was discussed here, I believe, yesterday. And that was, there was a shortfall, deficiency in this program in the current biennium. So what we're doing here is looking forward. We see the program, which currently serves about 500 people a month, growing by 2019 to 700 people. At least that's a projection. So these numbers, an increase in the funding, would be to accommodate that and to avoid any future deficiencies. The Minnesota Food Assistance Program, as I've mentioned before, mirrors the food stamp program. It is for legal immigrants who qualify for food stamps, but the food stamp program has not served them. They have to be over the age of 50, and the average age of a recipient is 64. So these are older immigrant adults who qualify for the SNAP program but are not eligible. Mr. Chair, with that, that concludes the Children and Family Services part of the presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Koppel.
So, Mr. Chair, if it's, I think we'll go ahead then and move to our Community Supports Administration. I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Jennifer DeCabillas to join me. So this is a new name we're introducing today. As many of you all know, we did some restructuring in the department, and we brought together our mental health divisions, our chemical dependency division, our disability services divisions, and our deaf and hard of hearing divisions together into a new administration called, and we just named this Community Supports. And we're delighted to have Jennifer join us this year to be the assistant commissioner of this new division. So I thought what I would do is perhaps go through just some of the first slides that describe some of the challenges that we see in our mental health system, and then I know I talked briefly about it from a high level, but then we'll, Jennifer will walk through some of the proposals in the governor's budget. Oops. I want to just start with, as I did with Children and Families, acknowledging, I think, some of the progress that we have made as a state. The school-length mental health grants, which were started in the 2000s and doubled by the 2013 legislature, are really making a difference in children's lives. You know, we do more of those than any other state. We're just held up as a national model. And I think when I went around the state and did a lot of regional roundtables, I would start with and saying, what's working in our mental health system in your part of the state? You know, where are the gaps, and then what are the priorities? And this is something that across the state people said, this is working. This is making a difference. And we also expanded the crisis response for children and adults. We have some more work to do on that, but we did make an important expansion. We increased some payment rates, and we established a few new benefits, including access for families on Medicaid to certified peer specialists. But when we talked with people all around our state in these different regional meetings and other meetings, these are what we see as the challenges that exist. There are others, but these are the primary ones that lead us to say our mental health system is fragile and that we need to address this. We do not have, our existing community capacity just does not meet our needs for a number of people. I mean, the waiting list to get into Anoka Regional Treatment Center is just one, you know, very clear example of this. But, you know, the waiting list there is backed up into hospital beds around our state and sometimes even in jails. Some of the children's services are not available in Minnesota. We surveyed counties, and I think there are about 300 or 400 children every year that we don't have a level of psychiatric residential treatment that serves these kids, and often we end up sending these children out of state to receive these services, or they're not receiving them. We have rates that are often insufficient to cover the cost of services. And we, I think, and many of you know about the closure of Riverwood in kind of the central part of our state that served five counties, 3,000 clients suddenly closing, but we've seen other closures as well. And we know that there are some important parts of our infrastructure that are teetering. Lack of treatment services for really some of the most, the children and adults with some of the most acute needs. And these are particularly, it's a small set, but it's an important one, that these children and adults that have, are some of our, that are mentally ill and have aggressive symptoms, that we are particularly challenged to serve them. We also have, as I think many of you all know, workforce issues. I think our entire state basically is a mental health professional shortage area. And that's why it's especially a problem in greater Minnesota, where certainly I heard stories of people having to drive an hour and a half, just to see a provider. And I think when we're focusing on really these infrastructure needs, we've also, and that's understandable, but we've not been able to make the investments in prevention and early intervention that we need, or to the investments we need for community supports for people in recovery. And those are important too, because those will stop folks cycling in and out of hospitals and emergency rooms if we have the supports in their community. We put together a chart, and I know this is too much detail for anyone to dive into here. We have one for children and one for adults. But basically, for different parts of the state, and you'll see these different regions, and the different parts of the infrastructure that that we have in our state, but not in all parts of our state. And so the green says in that area, and these the services meet the demand. Yellow means there's limited service in that area. And red means there's no provider located of that type in this area. And I just think when you look at this, what you'll see is a state, region by, and it differs region by region, but a state with a lot of yellow, some green, but more red than green. So what we tried to do to put together kind of the, our mental health proposal that's in the governor's budget is really look at these four buckets. What can we do more in prevention, in early intervention, in treatment, and in support for recovery? And so if you in this above the dotted line, you'll see things that we have, what that the state has been doing. And then below the line, you'll see some of the things that we're proposing to do to try and address some of the gaps that are out there. And Jennifer will walk through these in more detail, but I just wanted to at least try and present a bigger picture of what we're trying to do. As I said, there's a lot of great providers and great work being done in our mental health system, but it is just, but we just have a lot of gaps in different parts of our state.
Commissioner DeCavilius, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Jennifer DeCavilius, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services for Community Supports. We have a lot of proposals in front of you. They hopefully are in order, so I'm going to go through them in order. The first one that I would take your attention to is behavioral health homes. The behavioral health homes is a first step in developing a framework to provide services in a person-centered care. It's the creation of health homes that are specifically targeted to individuals with serious mental illness. We have a state option that allows us to leverage coordinated care through health homes for individuals with chronic conditions, and the department is recommending that we start with individuals with mental illness, as what we have found is that is a group that are high cost, tend to be 2 to 3 times higher cost in healthcare services than others, and high need. It is a population that has higher mortality rates, poor access to services, and a coordinated care model allows a team to work together in order to integrate those services better. What we do have is an opportunity under the federal option for a two-year period where we can draw down an enhanced federal match of 90%. We are looking to launch this proposal in January of 2016. And it is a part of our Minnesota Olmsted plan as far as making sure that we are coordinating care and individualizing care to meet individuals' needs. We have looked at the numbers. We have about 82,000 people in Minnesota health care programs who are eligible for behavioral health homes and are not receiving targeted case management at this point. By 2019, we expect to serve 20,000 individuals per month under this proposal. And we have 35 early adopters of providers who have expressed interest in providing this coordinated care model. The next proposal I have is early childhood mental health consultation. These are grants to mental health agencies to provide consults to child care agencies. What we have found as we have traveled across the state is that providers are continuously flagging in early childcare that there is a increased concern around behaviors that they are seeing in child care facilities, in preschoolers, in increased concern with family members who are struggling with mental illness, and that this is a child care system that doesn't always know how to intervene early on. So this proposal allows us to provide grants to mental health agencies with expertise in early childhood, to train providers who are working with high-risk and low-income families, and even more importantly than the training is to ensure that we have referrals to clinical services for parents and for children who are struggling with mental health concerns. This is similar to our school-linked mental health programs that Commissioner Jessen referenced earlier that we've seen significant success for. It is bringing it further upstream into the child care and the preschool age group to identify as early as possible before individuals even hit school. How do we intervene and ensure that people have the services and supports? Our goals are to reduce removal from child care venues, do early identification, early intervention, and ensure that our child care staff are well positioned to manage the behaviors they're seeing. The next proposal is the school-based diversion for students with co-occurring disorders. This is a pilot program to keep kids in school and engage them in treatment versus sending them through our correction system. The state has worked with SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, and the MacArthur Foundation over the past year to develop a model that is already gaining some national attention. And really what it is doing is partnering the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Chief of Police Association, and selected school sites to work to identify children that are struggling or youth that are struggling in the school systems and to provide rapid interventions versus removal from the school system. So there's a tiered approach with a full manual of how we can get in front of these instead of sending youth through our correction system with the goal of not having them enter juvenile justice but keeping kids in school. The next proposal we have is services and supports for first episode psychosis. These are grants to provide early identification and intervention specifically to 14 to 26-year-olds, which is often the time frame where we see first episodes of psychosis occurring. If early psychosis is often misdiagnosed or undiagnosed, and what happens is we rapidly see individuals who are withdrawing from school, withdrawing from colleges, socially withdrawing from families and friends, and it's often 10 years down the line or more before we get them in front of service providers, which at that point we have functional deterioration that has often happened in more extreme circumstances. So once again, we are looking to get upstream of that and provide education to mental health providers in early identification and effective interventions to identify when somebody may be experiencing some of these challenges, as well as focused efforts to bridge transitions between individuals who are in children's services moving into adult services so that we are watching and intervening quickly on these. The next proposal is improvement and expansion of mental health crisis services. This has several components to it, and it really is, once again, trying to, as Commissioner Jessen mentioned earlier, the matrix where we have scattered services available across the state of Minnesota and not a lot of consistency across. This is one effort to try to bring some consistency around crisis services. One of the proposals in here is establishes a statewide phone number for crisis care. Right now, if you are in any individual county, those numbers are going to be different. And it would create one venue where we could make sure individuals who struggle with mental health concerns and their family members have an accessible number that no matter where they are, they can access those crisis services. I caveat this often to 911. We have individuals that know how to call 911 and utilize that all the time, sometimes inappropriately. And if we have another standard number that they know for a mental health crisis, they can get dispatched to their local entity. The ideal would be to have less people showing up in our emergency departments. It also enhances oversight and training of our mobile crisis services, creating some standards across the state of Minnesota for the mobile crisis team operations. And in addition, it adds a 24/7 phone consultation for crisis teams who are serving people who also have traumatic brain injury or intellectual disabilities and are experiencing a mental health crisis, so that there is on-call 24/7 consult for those mobile crisis teams to meet those unique needs. The next proposal is expansion of crisis respite care. Respite services are a great resource, and again, on that matrix, you'll see that they don't exist across the state of Minnesota. Crisis respite is aimed at providing families who are raising youth who have significant mental health, behavioral health challenges, to allow them to have a respite period when things are getting heated in the home environment, instead of doing an inpatient stay, instead of doing an out-of-home placement, that they have another option for that respite period of time. This proposal expands the capacity for respite services throughout the state of Minnesota, and it also has the department exploring options for potentially having medical assistance cover respite care in order to maximize federal funding and ensure we have statewide access. What we hope is to cover an additional 500 to 1,000 children utilizing this funding. The next proposal I have is certifying behavioral health clinics. This is the creation of a plan for certified community mental health clinics. What it does is it allows us to apply for a federal planning grant or design grant that we are anticipating happening in September and aligns us with the 2015 federal standards for certified community behavioral health clinics. This opportunity helps us take community mental health clinics and create some standardization, create some integration with our ACT teams, our mobile crisis. It really sets a whole foundation to have these programs not only covering their cost, it is a prospective model similar to the federally qualified healthcare centers. So it is a payment methodology difference, but it also makes requirements for our mental health clinics to standardize what's available, how accessible it is, and how individuals are working together to coordinate care. The next item is building community capacity to address adverse childhood experiences. This is a request to work with the Children's Mental Health Collaboratives and the Family Service Collaboratives across the state to reduce adverse childhood experiences, often referred to as ACEs, which are trauma experiences that, such as child abuse and neglect, domestic violence in the home, substance abuse or mental illness in the home. Things that over time and over the years, if a child is repeatedly exposed to these types of traumas without intervention, often are the individuals that we see deeper end in services as young adults and as older adults. So the approach here is to train child-serving agencies in the identification of trauma and interventions to prevent and reduce these trauma occurrences. The collaboratives we're looking for about 15 to 20 grants under this proposal. Utilizing those collaboratives will train community partners in identification of traumatic experiences and develop local initiatives. Those local initiatives will meet the community's needs around what are the patterns and trends. It could be anything from home visiting to universal trauma precautions, and ultimately developing communities of learning, so attaching to a national website where there are resources and tools for communities to pick up and share knowledge and experience across the board. The next proposal we have is the psychiatric residential treatment facilities. This proposal establishes psychiatric residential treatment facilities, PRTFs, to support children with serious mental illnesses who are currently going underserved. You heard Commissioner Jessen mention earlier that when we surveyed the counties, there are about 300 youth identified every year that have highly aggressive, high mental health needs and are not being served because the institutions or residential programming to meet those needs does not exist. In addition, in this program, we have the establishment of some extended stay hospital psychiatric beds on a contract basis. So looking to have 30 contract beds available for extended stay for children that are available locally, including those children that are currently served in the CABS programs, the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services programs.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Jessen.
I'd like to ask Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry to join us at the table for this part of this mental health discussion as well, just because this is one of these areas where, as I said, as we're looking at what we need to do as a state, we're also reexamining what's the role our direct care and treatment will provide. And I think that she would be asked her to address both the CABS closure as well as a couple of the next items.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. Commissioner Berry, please state your name for the record and start with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So the next page in your budget document, pages 64 and 65, is the corresponding or partner page to the description that Assistant Commissioner DeCabellis gave you about the expansion of psychiatric residential treatment facilities along with the using of extended stay contracts at hospitals. If we're able to create that system, we'll be able to also close our facility in Willmar. We call it the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Program. A couple important things you need to know about that program, though. The census has been very low in that program for a number of years. We're currently serving 5 children in that program. We think that's for a couple of reasons. One is because when it's time to, this is a hospital program, parents and family and those who support a child want to stay close to the child. And this is the only facility of its type in the state. We really think using private providers, either on a contract basis or the development of these private residential treatment programs, will eliminate the need for this type of service in this program. A couple of other things to know. The building that we're currently using is an extremely old building. It's not amenable to rehabilitation or remodeling, and it's very, very difficult to provide services to the children that we are providing services to in this program. So this would, again, partner with the previous page, and we would close this program.
Commissioner Berry, could you just specifically with the Willmar closing, and you said that there are currently 5 people there. Could you tell us what it was maybe like 2 years ago and 4 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to get that specific information, and we certainly can provide it to you, but since I've had this position since April of 2013, I don't know that our census has ever gone above 10. It's licensed as a 16-bed facility, but we have I don't know that we've ever reached full capacity in that program, and I think the highest census that I can remember, at least in the last year, has been 10 children.
Thank you, Commissioner.
The next item in your packet is stabilizing mental health services payment structures. This is a recommendation to do an analysis of our mental health rate methodology across the board for mental health services. You heard Commissioner Jessen mention the fragility of the mental health services. We've had several closures of programs and constantly are hearing from providers that the rates have not kept up with costs. And so many are operating at loss or very slim margins. And the risk we have is we can't lose more providers in mental health services. We need to create more capacity, not less. So one of these proposals is to do an analysis of the rates and bring back to the legislature some recommendations. So we would be looking for a consultant who's experienced on MA reimbursable services to go through all the rate infrastructure and make some recommendations of where do we need to adjust rates as well as can we draw down any additional federal dollars where we're not drawing them down today. It also has in here an ability to increase rates in the short term while we do that analysis to do some immediate adjustments. One is to increase rates for our mobile mental health crisis teams. Mobile mental health, as we just talked about, is just critical to be able to divert people from higher cost care and to keep them in their communities. The rate currently as it sits is lower than an inpatient office visit for therapy. Really hard to have a high-skilled team out diverting emergencies and de-escalating crisis services at those kind of rates. So the recommendation on the interim as we look at the larger rate structure is to bring those rates up to at least that of an inpatient therapy visit. The other proposal in here is an interim solution for other services. We have spent the last year working with service providers for intensive residential services, our ERTS, residential crisis services, and non-residential ACT programs, our sort of community treatment programs, which are, again, our deep-end intensive services for individuals with the most complex needs. And what we have found in those areas is that they are very fragile and they are at risk of further closures. So part of the proposal, again, is while we look through this analysis, doing some short-term grants to help keep those individuals whole and keep that capacity existing for the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chairman, then, and members, the next pages are 68 and 69. This is the public psychiatric residency collaboration. We would work with the University of Minnesota to build a residency program for psychiatrists who want to work in public service. We have a very difficult time finding psychiatric coverages. You heard Commissioner Jessen talk about workforce shortage areas across the state. We're all impacted by that, and we are particularly impacted by that across a number of our treatment programs. By the time this program is fully expanded, we would have to have up to 4 residents a year available to the department for psychiatrists in their residency, available to the department, not just for direct care and treatment services, but be available statewide to community crisis teams and others as we're working to build that community capacity. So this really becomes a resource for both the state and for counties as we're building mental health capacity in the state. Then on to page 70 and 71 is an increase in capacity for individuals with complex conditions. You heard earlier Commissioner Justin refer to the backup at Anoka. It is real and we feel it on a daily basis. We currently are reserving 3 beds a day to make sure that we can place people in our facility who are coming to us from jails. Under the law that was passed two years ago, the 48-hour law. And it's put a certain amount of stress on the Anoka facility. And so this proposal in front of you would provide more capacity across the state. It would be both in intensive rehabilitative treatment services and in community behavioral health services. So it would be a mix of those kinds of services, a step down from hospital services. But we have a number of people at Anoka that don't any longer need to be at a hospital level of care, and they could step down to a different level of service. So this will provide us with more treatment services across the state, and much needed way to relieve some of the pressure that we're feeling at Anoka. Anything else? Then on pages 72 and 73 are a budget change page that relate to the Minnesota Security Hospital and the condition on our license. I was before you yesterday talking about the deficiency associated with the condition on our license, and you also heard from Jerry Kerber and Carol Olson a little over a week ago about all of those conditions on the license. To fully operate this program at the level we are currently operating with the number of staff that we have in our program, we will need $5.5 million a year to sustain the operation of that program with the additional staff, both the unit staff and the specialized staff that provide treatment in this program. Okay.
The next item is housing with support grants. What we have found, again, as we've talked to various areas across the state, is that housing needs are consistently in our community's top three needs around mental health. And when we look at individuals who are in institutions, whether it's a local community hospital, whether it is a private hospital or our state-run institutions, what we often find is housing with supports is the missing piece for individuals to move back into the community. So this proposal asks for an additional $1.5 million in fiscal year 2016 to provide further capacity in our housing and supports. We would be able to, with this additional funding, we would be able to go from serving 420 households with serious mental illness who need this type of support in the community to over 1,200 individuals by June of 2018. We have seen a significant need. 55% of adults who are homeless have a mental illness. We have seen the need that individuals who are complex and in institutions right now, the traditional housing options don't seem to meet their needs, and this would give us some flexibility to better wrap services and supports around individuals. This proposal is also a part of our 2013 Olmstead Plan and the Heading Home Minnesota Plan as well. The next proposal you have in front of you is the Assertive Community Treatment Quality Improvement and Expansion Program. As I'm sure many of you know, ACT, Assertive Community Treatment, is a high-touch intervention aimed at serving individuals with complex mental health needs who need significant supports in the community. This proposal is to expand access, looking to create some standardization across ACT and ensure that we have fidelity to the federal requirements for ACT services, as well as with those standards and consistencies expand some capacity. So we are looking to add a Forensic Act team. I'm sure many of you have heard the challenges we have with individuals who are high recidivizers into the correction system but truly need community supports to stabilize their mental health or chemical health needs. This proposal would create a Forensic Act as well as expand two additional ACT teams, looking at that matrix to make sure that geographically we have services available for two additional ACT teams in outgoing years. The next proposal in front of you is transition initiatives flexibility. In 2013, the legislature authorized $8.2 million in funding to assist in transitioning individuals with complex needs back to the community from state-operated facilities. We have been able to progressively move. We've placed 39 people as of our December numbers, utilizing this funding. However, we've also along the way learned where we have gaps, and what we're asking for is to expand the population that are eligible for this programming to individuals who are 65 years of age and older. So the previous authority capped that at age 64, and we see as people are aging in our institutions a need to move those individuals out into the community, and having some flexible funding to better meet their needs would help us do so. This proposal also expands it beyond Anoka and Minnesota Security Hospital to the Forensic Nursing Home at St. Peter, as well as community behavioral health hospitals. So we have individuals there that also traditional programs aren't a discharge plan that meets their needs, and this flexibility would allow us to move more of those individuals as well. A second part of this proposal is to also authorize a pilot program. This is a budget-neutral proposal. It is using the existing funding, but that second part, that pilot program, is looking at the community hospitals, private facilities, as well as public facilities where there are individuals who are committed to the commissioner on wait lists for Anoka, and it allows us to say if they are medically stable, how do we use these funds to also help them get out of their beds so that we create capacity for individuals in the community who need access to those beds. We do believe we can, with this funding, provide services to an additional 100 individuals. The next proposal in front of you is withdrawal management system modification. This is to initiate planning for a new model of care for persons who are going through detox. What we are seeing is detox services, again, are not consistent across the state of Minnesota. Individuals are having to drive significant distances to receive detox services. We also see an opportunity for withdrawal management to be seen as a medical model. It really is creating two new levels of care, medical and clinical withdrawal management, where we believe we can tap Medicaid and Medicare funding. So first part of the proposal is for the state to develop those standards for withdrawal management. And the second part of it is to have the authority to go work with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare around receiving approval for withdrawal management services to be considered a medical assistance benefit. When detox services don't exist in the community, what happens is individuals back up into our correction system or they back up into our emergency departments, which is an ineffective use of our dollars. We would be returning to the legislature with a funding methodology before moving forward. So this is just to do the planning and the initial approvals with CMS, and we would bring it back here.
If I may, Mr. Chair, members, make one additional one set of comments about the budget pages relating to our Olmstead plan. You heard Assistant Commissioner DeCubilis talk about a number of our mental health initiatives that are also very much trying to help us drive towards the Olmstead plan's goals of letting people with disabilities live and work and interact with others in the most integrated fashion possible, consistent with their choice. And I think a lot of our mental health proposals do that. It's a lot about getting people out of institutions into housing or less restrictive places. But two other things I just wanted to draw to your attention. One is our GRH reform, so our group residential housing, which is a state-funded, so 100% state dollars, that go towards paying for room and board and for some services for people with disabilities. We have a number of people served through group residential housing, and we have another set through MSA Shelter Needy. So this budget proposal, which is on page 84, I believe, of your book, will over time combine those two programs and streamline access to them. Now, these are really complicated programs, and as many of you who have been on this committee for a while know, the legislature makes change, adds something here, adds a provider there, kind of a different rate here, and we really want to simplify and unify this process. We also want to make it so that rather than having the dollars attached to the provider, if I want to go, I need to live at this provider, and you know, then my services are by this provider, have it more individualized housing assistance, that the person who qualifies then is able to say, I'm going to take these housing dollars and I'm going to choose, is it that provider or those services, or where there's a way I can want to have live in my apartment with supports. So it will be much more individually driven, and we think a much better way to serve people. I think that to meet the Olmstead Plan's goals, housing's foundational. And I think kind of this is kind of a major reform of two important housing programs. And I also, one other matter I just wanted to make sure you were aware of is the data collection plan to prevent and end homelessness. And we talked before about those single night counts where we contract with Wilder to go out and, you know, find out about who is homeless and what do they look like. That's how I could tell you that 46% of the people who are homeless on a given night are children and youth. But the more we can actually learn about who are homeless, what's working to get them into homes, what are their profiles, the more we're better able to target and get those folks, wherever possible, into housing. So this is a data collection proposal that's mostly in the DHS budget, but there's also a portion of this in the Minnesota housing budget. So I just wanted to alert you to that. And also to say, when we talk about Olmstead, that this isn't just about the Department of Human Services budget. So we've talked about some of our mental health pieces and our GRH reform initiative. But there are a number of other key things in other parts of the budget. And I just wanted to let you all know about a couple of them. Because I think you might say, wait, we thought Olmstead was also about, you know, employment. And what about education? But there are initiatives in the governor's budget for DEED, for extended employment, for employment services for people with mental illness, some grants. There's some proposals in the education budget for positive behavioral interventions and supports. It's something in the Department of Corrections budget for offender health care. An important program in Minnesota Housing, really expansion of the Bridges program, which gives housing assistance to people with mental illness. So I just wanted the committee to kind of know that we're trying to look at this holistically, and it's not just all in the DHS budget.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. And we do have a question from Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Jessen, we ended talking a little bit about group residential housing, and I know your department's been working night and day in implementation of the Olmsted plan. And I've had some business owners up in my area and then a little bit further north that's had some concerns around some of the GRH changes. I know your agency's had meetings around the state with providers about that, and the concern is this idea, I understand the intention of getting people independence and autonomy, but getting people that perhaps are getting some pretty intensive services in a setting, and now as your folks have been presenting around the state, talking about getting as many people in independent living as possible, that I'm having service providers come to me and say, you know, well, we're not able to bill for everything, taking care of an individual with some mental illness problems. They have some concerns about some of the population that's being ready to be shifted out of their setting to independent living, where someone needs to be reminded half a dozen to a dozen times a day to eat or to bathe or to clothe themselves. So the concern is that while we implement Olmsted, and that's a great solution for a portion of the population, the folks that have contacted me have a concern that perhaps your agency is pushing in some population areas that maybe it isn't as appropriate to have that independent, you know. You ask a lot of folks, and 9 times out of 10, they're going to say, yeah, I want my own apartment. Well, clearly, in some instances, that's not the right solution, and we could be setting people up for failure and more expenses down the road. So I'm just wondering how that's taken into consideration by your agency and how that's evaluated and what the plan is.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, thank you so much for that question. And I'm going to answer it the best I can, but we would also be happy if there's some providers you'd like us to meet with to sit down and talk with them. You know, when I talk about Olmsted, I talk about kind of independence and choice, and they go together. You know, I think this is about individuals having choices, but we know a lot of people with disabilities are being very well served by very good providers, and their choice will be to stay where they are, you know, and to get the services where they are. I think, though, and this is also applies to when we're thinking about employment. You know, we would like to have a choice where possible for people to have competitive employment, but it's a choice. But I think, you know, well, I'm trying to think of more to say about that. But I do think that we have a set of young adults that are coming up, kind of those 14 to 22-year-olds, and I think they have a different set of expectations, perhaps, than people had who are coming of age with disabilities 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that's they're a group that may very well say, no, that's a choice I want, whereas someone who has been, you know, living, you know, happily and being served in their setting was like, no, this is the choice I want. This is right for me. This is about choice. But I think that there's a lot of swirling and misinformation around that, and we're really happy to sit down and talk with you and those providers.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen, and Commissioner DeCavalis. Are you concluded with your portion of the presentation? And Commissioner Berry, you have one more section to complete today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, let's try to complete that as soon as we can and complete the presentation. And if we have any time for questions, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next page, 90 and 91, is a proposal that would increase the cost of care to 100% for counties, a county payment, when a client at Anoka is not meeting medical care needs. If you look at the middle of the page, our current structure is a graduated structure. The longer somebody is with us, the more the county shares in the cost of that care. What we are finding, though, is that people are being committed to the commissioner, and they do, from the day they come to us, they do not meet a hospital level of care. So we think this proposal will create the right incentive so that we don't have people coming to us or staying with us for a long time after they no longer need the services of a psychiatric hospital at Anoka. The next page is a partner page between myself and Assistant Commissioner DiCabella. So 92 and 93 is around our chemical dependency programs, and I'll let Jennifer start.
A portion of this request is looking at how do we better meet individuals' needs who are struggling with chemical dependency and are in some of our state programs. The recommendation is to provide a new base rate for providers who are state certified in integrated dual diagnosis treatment, IDDT. This IDDT complexity rate is meant to take care of complex populations that are currently served in state operated services because there isn't another venue that can meet their needs. With this certification, it will allow private providers in our communities to bring up their staffing levels, to pass certification to meet complex need populations, and it recommends changing the rate, increasing the rate, in order to cover the costs of those increased staffing. And it really is for individuals who not only have complex needs as they go through recovery, but may also present a risk to public safety and so need more intensive supports around them. It will allow us to focus our care program on the individuals that cannot be served in the community. And by increasing a rate that could be provided to community providers, it allows us to have some capacity in the community as well. One of the assumptions in this is that it does assume CMS approval of a new rate, but it would allow us, again, to better meet individual needs without state-operated services being the one venue where these individuals can go.
And Mr. Chairman and members, the corresponding impact on direct care and treatment is that a number of our care programs would be downsized, and if the provider community is able to step up and care with for enough people with complex conditions, we would actually close one of our facilities. So this is a reshaping of our chemical dependency treatment programs so that we're in the business of only serving people that can't be served by others. You know, the last 2 years we have come back here asking for deficiency requests associated with the care program. In its current form, it's just not sustainable. So then to continue on page 95, we have the Jensen settlement administrative costs. Last session, the legislature provided us with funds to support a program called the Successful Life Project. Our responsibility with that program was to follow up with all 325 or 30 class members that they were people who had resided at the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program. So we needed staff to do that very intense follow-up that is being required by the court. But there are also other requirements of the Jensen settlement. There are 104 evaluation criteria that the court uses to determine if we are in compliance with the Jensen settlement. We provide monthly reports to the court. It's quite labor intensive, and the court monitor is very, very involved in the day-to-day activities of the department and its compliance with the Jensen settlement. So these costs represent the infrastructure to support compliance with the Jensen settlement. And in the past, we were paying for them out of direct care and treatment, and we now think it should be part of the department's general operations. The next four pages then, 97, 98, 99, and 100, all represent operating adjustments for both state-operated services and the sex offender treatment program. It is those two programs that make up direct care and treatment, where we provide direct care to clients and patients. So these are operating base adjustments that represent the costs associated with contractual increases and that they are in our base for the next biennium.
Let me mess up here.
Okay. So our final proposal on indirect care and treatment is reforming the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So the first budget part of this, and the change items are on pages 101 to 103, is to equalize the county share. So there's a county share for clients when they're at Moose Lake or St. Peter. Now that we are starting to see the court provisionally discharge a few of those clients, to have the same county share for the cost of you know, making sure that the clients and the community is safe and they're getting treatment during provisional discharge. That's savings to that. The other portion of the governor's budget for MSOP really builds upon the bill that Representative Liebling carried a couple of years ago, which provides for a couple of things, and these are items that have been recommended by the Office of Legislative Auditor, by the Sex Offender Task Force, and as well as for some court experts. In the Carjans litigation, as I think most of you are aware, this case is going to trial starting on February 9th. But this would increase the frequency of client evaluation and risk assessment so that every client had a risk assessment or evaluation at least every 2 years, a recommendation kind of from all of these experts that we should be doing this. So it would require us to, you know, hire 14 additional FTEs to do these risk assessments. And it would also invest in less restrictive alternatives. So the proposal would be to have, across the next few years, two less restrictive but still secure and safe places for parts of the population to go outside of Moose Lake or St. Peter. Now, we cannot move them there ourselves. This would be, they would all have to be subject to court approval. But as I think many of you have followed this know, that after about a year and a half ago, we put out an RFP to find out what private providers would be willing to do, who would be willing to take some of these folks, because we saw that the courts were starting to do more provisional discharges. And a number of providers stepped up and said we could provide either the residential part or we could provide the treatment. And so for our clients with cognitive impairments, there are a number of providers that are willing to provide for some of those clients. But we didn't have anyone, for example, who said that they would be willing to provide for our clients who require nursing home level of care or assisted living. And certainly we don't think it was appropriate to take these people and put them into regular nursing homes. There's also, we do not have private providers who have been willing to say we'll take some of these clients that have been convicted, that are committed based upon juvenile offenses where there are no adult convictions. And we know that's a kind of another set that might possibly, these experts say, be ready for a secure but less restrictive environment. So the proposal provides for the operations costs. I think in the long term you'll see that there probably are savings but we at some point would be having to kind of get up and running a couple of other alternatives while we're still paying for the ongoing costs at St. Peter and Moose Lake. I do think this is something we're in discussion with the governor's office about, whether this should be part of a bonding proposal that the governor's talked about having. I think the other part of this would be to increase the capacity for the judicial branch. You know, it is taking too long for people to get through the process, through the SCAP process. The SCAP is a Supreme Court appeals panel that makes a decision about whether or not someone can be provisionally discharged. That has been, a lot of experts have said this is taking too long. I think the judicial judges I've met with, you know, agree with that, but they need additional resources to be able to speed that up. So we put money in for that. We're still in discussions with the judicial branch and the state court administrative office about what exactly is it they would need to be able to process these cases in a more efficient manner. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, we've come to the end of, I think, what's on the agenda for today.
Thank you, Commissioner Justin, Commissioner Berry. We appreciate you walking through that. I also appreciate members kind of holding questions. It's a lot of material to walk through, and we wanted to make sure that you were able to at least proceed through your presentation. We will just have time for a few questions today, but what the intent is, so members understand, will be to complete the remainder of the book tomorrow. And then we will have the commissioners back for additional follow-up and questions that we will very likely have once we go into the to the pieces of it. One of the just very kind of overview questions that I had in looking at the budget and looking at the books was just from a leadership standpoint from the governor's initiative to change the groupings and coordination around mental health. And can you talk a little bit about that, about what the goals of that particular decision are, and what are some of the potential roadblocks that you see moving forward, both in management and delivery of services and also potentially funding?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as I think I said earlier, but we did bring together our divisions, our disability services divisions, our adult and children's mental health divisions, our ADAD, so our drug and alcohol division, as well as deaf and hard of hearing together in this new administration. And several goals. I mean, for one, as far as the mental health issues that you raised, Mr. Chair, we have people with mental illness who are served in our waiver programs and our disability services division, as well as, obviously, they're a real focus of the work in our children's and adult mental health divisions. And I, you know, frankly, did not think that these divisions were coordinating as well as they should, and were not serving people with mental illness in as coordinated a fashion as I wanted them to. So that was kind of part of my goal, Mr. Chair, and I think that Assistant Commissioner DeCubilius has done a good job really addressing some of these issues in Hennepin County, and so I wanted her to work with our staff to make sure that we're better serving people with mental illness across the agency. But also, I think that there's a lot of what people need in that we serve through these divisions. It's about housing. It's about employment. It's about a lot of the community supports. So there's a lot of commonality and work that we are doing separately in these different divisions that I think will collectively do better together. That's why, for an example, we're having kind of a housing division within this new administration that'll look at housing for all of these populations that we serve. Because, as I said, I think housing is foundational to be having those successful lives in the community. So I think that better integration and better services for the people that we serve were certainly high on my priority list.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. We also have Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of want to go back to the Wilmer facility, and so who's ever going to be able to answer the questions about that? All right. So can you provide me an example of who those private providers will be? And I realize, I mean, I've heard actually quite a bit about this facility from various levels of whatever the problems are. And these are some extremely, extremely high needs youth. This is not just a foster care facility by any means, because I know we've had staff assaulted out there, and obviously when they're working with juveniles, it's a whole other level of problems that they have to encounter trying to handle that. So one of the reasonings was, you know, you want kids to be closer to parents. And so, I mean, how many providers are out there that are going to provide these services, and how are you going to assure me that they're going to be closer to parents anyway?
Commissioner?
That's one.
Mr. Chair, Representative. There was a little more than one question there, I think, but let me try, and you can tell me if I don't get it right.
Okay, it's a start.
Okay. So we have been in conversation with providers, and we do think when we have this ability to contract for beds for this higher level of care than we have in our state right now, we need this kind of level for these, you know, 300 to 400 kids that we talked about, that is a little less than a hospital level of care, but much more than our children's residential programs provide today. It's a much more kind of psychiatric skilled, clinically driven model. We know that there are providers that are interested in doing that. When we talk with some of our children's, groups that provide our children, current children's residential areas, some of them are interested in kind of providing, stepping up their services and providing this new level of care for children. So I do believe that we have private providers that are interested in providing it. And I've tried to be careful about this. You'll notice that, like, for the adults with particularly complex mental health, mental illnesses, I think there, when I talk to providers in hospitals, we don't see the providers there who we think are willing to step up, which is why we're saying we need our state-operated services to provide those three new facilities. So it's hard to name it, to give you names right now. We've had a lot of conversations around this. You know, the CABS closure is scheduled in the governor's proposed budget for the end of this year. Obviously, we're trying to, you know, provide some time for us to assess and make sure that that would be real. And that's why we're also having kind of some contract beds as an option, kind of to bridge us to when these new treatment facilities, and this would be an additional 150 beds for psychiatric treatment, residential treatment for kids in the state under this proposal. And I agree, certainly, the work done with these very, very challenging children at the facility is good. It is excellent. We've won a lot of awards, national awards, for the work we do, but it's not serving very many children, and I think part of that is the access to their families.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, so then the plan for the staff that are going to be laid off, or where are they going? What is there another, if we're going to expand adult care, are we going to try to do that back out in Wilmer? Or because I know that whole facility, just like we've had all over the state, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, so many different places, we've decimated communities over the decades by shutting some of these facilities down. And now it feels to me like we're taking another step in that direction as well, too.
Commissioner Jess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, we do plan, as you can see from our proposal, we would be downsizing in some areas of our direct care and treatment, but doing more in others, including in the mental health area. And we want to be very clear that, like, the three mental health new facilities that we propose in the governor's budget would be not in the metro, but in greater Minnesota. I think we're trying to be very cognizant of that, and we will be as well as when we provide the contracts for either contract beds or ultimately for these new children's residential psychiatric facilities, that they need to be spread appropriately around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
We talked about the sex offender program. I was just trying to gauge your feeling on how you're feeling this year that we're going to be able to accomplish a bill that we can all come together on finally after all these years to do whatever reforms that we need to do to avoid the litigation issue.
Well, we're going to be hearing more about that probably in the very, very close future, so I'm sure we'll be discussing that again this year. Representative Liebler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit. We have people here who might not be as familiar with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and where we're at with that and the litigation that's going on and the signals we've had from the court. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the proposal here in the governor's budget might interact with what's going on in the court, because there are a lot of timing issues here and what our expectation is about what might happen as a result of that litigation, just to give it a little bit more context for people.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'll do my best to give a summary. I certainly don't have a crystal ball and cannot predict what a federal judge will do. But as I said earlier, the case over the constitutionality of our sex offender treatment program is going to trial starting on February 9th. The judge has blocked out most of the rest of February for phase one of the trial, but I think it's a phase that will be pretty important. I think he wants to get that wrapped up in February. So I would assume that perhaps there would be a decision before the end of the legislative session. Having said that, I can't predict what a federal judge will do. You know, the judge has issued a number of opinions. I'm happy to share them with anyone who wants to read them. They're public, where he has been highly critical of the program. We did have, he appointed four experts to give him advice about the program. The experts actually, you know, did say some supportive things about the program, you know, about the treatment that's taking place there, you know, and but also had criticisms of the program. You know, it's some so in the governor's budget proposal, I'm not here saying, oh, this would satisfy the plaintiffs or this would satisfy a federal judge. I don't know what, I can't read their minds. We were really trying to look at what are some very basic steps we could take to move the program forward, which would address what a lot of experts, not just court experts, are saying we need to do. We need to evaluate people more to see if they're in the right phase of treatment, and we need to provide kind of quicker access to the court system through the provisional discharge, and we need to make sure if a court does provisionally discharge someone that there is a place for them to go that we believe will keep the provide them treatment, but keep the community safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Liebling. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Commissioner. Set the stage here a little bit. I graduated high school with this woman. She had a son. They live up here. Their boy, her son, actually won an award in sixth grade for DARE awareness program. Mm-hmm. Today, he is battling heroin addiction, and he could be any one of our children. I mean, just a beautiful young man, educated, grew up in a loving, caring suburban home. I was looking for some help, and I asked him, and I told him, look me in the eye, does he want my help? And he said, absolutely. And I said, I'll do what I can. I called former Representative Doug Maslow, who is now a judge, and just asked him for some advice. And he said, Rod, all we see when these people come to our courtroom is the theft charges. He said, my advice would be just have him be honest and tell him I'm an addict and I messed up. He did that. He served his time. The question or the concern that I have going through this from being an addict to detox, having access to the prescription, the medication to help him through detox, through the treatment, the recovery, finding housing, education, and get the young man back on his feet again. There's some gaps in the process, and we going through this, I wanted to be there. One, I care for the individual, but two, just to help understand the process too. There's some gaps. Now, I know I've got a concern. With every concern, there's a request. I'm not sure what the request is, but I just wanted to share that with you, and if you could comment on the system as a whole.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, thank you for that great question. Let me make a comment on the system as a whole and then tell you a couple of things in the governor's proposals that address this, but I will say when we look at the system as a whole, kind of as we did with our mental health system, our CD system also, we see real gaps. We see some great services, but we see some real gaps. And our CD system, I think, is also kind of evolving. Now that the federal law says that CD treatment is an essential health benefit, more people have insurance, and I think that will drive some changes as well. But we don't have, like in our mental health system, we don't have enough supports for recovery in our CD system. And we don't have, especially for some of the highest needs people, folks with highest needs in the CD world, we don't have all the services we should for them either. And on prevention, we need to be doing more because, you know, I think it's something people are afraid to come forward and talk with. It's great that he was willing to talk with you. At the department overall, we're taking a kind of holistic look, especially in light of these law changes and insurance changes. What should our CD system look like? Because in the past, we've counted on the state to fill in a lot of gaps that we may not have to fill in as many going forward. We came this year, I think, with our mental health kind of comprehensive look. In this proposal, we're doing a few pieces on CD, but we really are looking to come to the legislature with a more holistic look at the CD next year, and I would welcome your participation in that. A couple of things that we're doing in this budget, though. You heard Assistant Commissioner Koppel talk about our work for pregnant mothers, especially we have so many, with this huge increase in babies born addicted, with, you know, moms with prenatal exposures to opioids, so to heroin and to other prescription drugs, especially a problem. with our Native American moms. So that's kind of one thing we're trying to do to work with the tribes to identify and work with those moms and get them into treatment earlier. You'll also hear in our healthcare presentation tomorrow a program we're trying to do to bring together people and start addressing prescribing standards, because a lot of kids who end up on heroin started with prescription drugs. So that's another thing you'll hear about tomorrow. You also heard Jennifer DeCabilius talk about raising kind of the rates to deal with our most complex CD cases, because we need to do that to really provide more holistic services to them. But it is something that we're looking, trying to take that big picture look at this year, and we'd love to have you with us.
Thank you, Commissioner Justin. And we also had members Purcell, Grunhagen, McDonald, and Franson with questions. I apologize that we will not have time to get to those today, but we will have the testifiers back for questions. And so save those, write them down. And members can either take the budget books with you, or if you wouldn't mind doing staff a favor and just putting them on the cart on the way out, we do appreciate that. So we'll pick up again here tomorrow where we left off on the budget overview, and health next week. We should finish DHS tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.